United States against Berg is our next argument this morning. Ms. Schroeder.
May it please the Court. Cheryl Schroeder and I represent Brian Berg. Mr. Berg is asking this Court to reverse and remand his conviction for attempting to entice a minor to engage in sexual activity. He's asking that it be reversed based on two bases. One, that there was insufficient evidence to find him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And secondly, based on the improper vouching in the closing arguments by the assistant U.S. attorney. In the case, in order to prove the attempt, the government has to prove that Mr. Berg acted with specific intent to commit the underlying crime and that basically he took a substantial step toward the completion of that act. Judge Bucklow held in this case that she did not believe that Brian Berg intended to commit a sexual act on November 11th when he, in fact, met with detectives believing that it was Kerry, an individual he'd been communicating with that was 16 years old.
Ms. Schroeder, your brief states that the government had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Berg had the specific intent to engage in sexual activity on November 11th and not sometime in the future. But do you think a better characterization would be that the government had to prove that he had the specific intent to engage in sexual activity on November 11th or within the 51 days following?
Well, I believe that they need to prove that he intended the act on that night, because if they didn't have to prove that, there's no evidence that there would have been a second night. There's no evidence that Kerry wouldn't have been 17 at the time that the sexual act was finally committed. So if it didn't happen on that night, there's no evidence that it may have ever happened at all.
Can I ask you this? How do you know, or I guess we should say, how do we know that Kerry was just 51 days from turning 17?
Well,
she posted a birth date on one of her profiles. I was under the impression that she just reported a birth year.
She did report a birth year. And I believe what's stated in the brief is what she stated was Kerry for you 1991. And the fact that she was born in 1991 made her 16 years old. They were supposed to meet on November 11th, so you can assume that in 1992, sometime prior to May when he initially started communicating with her, that was when she would turn 17. So certainly within that year, or at the least amount, 51 days, she would be turning 17 years old. So if the state or if the government didn't prove that the sexual act was going to be committed that night, there's a good chance that she could have been 17 sometime in the future when it possibly would have happened, if it would have happened. And that's where the 51 days comes in. But they can't convict him for a crime he may commit in the future. And that's basically what the government was asking the jury to do, because there was sufficient evidence that it wasn't going to happen that night. And that was Judge Bucklow's ruling, was that she didn't believe that the sexual act was going to happen that night based on the facts of the case.
But, Ms. Schroeder, the charge is broader than I think you're arguing. He was charged with attempting to persuade her over a significant period of time from late May of 97 until that November 11th date. That seems broader to me that the criminal conduct alleged is the attempt, the grooming, I guess, as it's called, over that period of time.
Correct. And he was attempting to persuade and entice, but he still has to ultimately intend the final act.
Otherwise,
it's just language.
Right. And in evaluating the various chats they had, his appearance on the day in question and his subsequent admission, doesn't the jury make that determination as to what his intent was in all of those contacts that he had or attempted to have with her?
Well, the subsequent statement that he made was clearly challenged by Brian Berg. He said he never intended for sexual acts to occur that night, that this detective, he'd never been arrested before, he's chained to a wall, repeatedly asked him the questions. He believed that this was being videotaped and that his denial, and ultimate agreeing, because that's the only answer he's going to take, that that's when he finally agrees in his statement alone that sexual acts could have occurred that night. But the statement is contrary to the evidence. And in the evidence, he had 20 minutes. He was meeting Carrie at 8:15. She had to be back by 9 o'clock. They'd never met before. And he had no indicia that he had no condoms, no pornography, anything that would indicate that he actually intended a sexual act to occur. In addition, this was not how he had a pattern. Katie, who testified at trial, testified that when she met Brian Berg, she was 16 years old, or she told him she was 16 years old. She was, in fact, 13 or 14. She testified that they drove around for close to a year before anything sexual happened with her. Brian Berg said he had met other women that were 16 years of age on the chats, and that he would meet with them. Nothing happened on the first time. Nothing happened on the second time. That it was always after that that things happened. And generally, or always, when these girls were of age. Katie would have been 17 or older when the first sexual act occurred. So in conjunction with the evidence that night, the lack of time, him wanting to meet in a public place, not a private place, the lack of having any type of evidence that he intended for anything sexual to happen, you have this pattern where he meets these women, he talks to them online, he does have very sexual conversations with them, and he indicates that this is what he likes to do online, that if people like to, they continue to talk. If they don't, they don't have to continue with the conversation. But that when he meets them, nothing initially happens. And that was the pattern that Brian Berg had with these.
His relationship with Katie began before she was even 16, his physical relationship.
But he believed, and Katie admitted in her testimony, that she had lied to Brian Berg, that when she was 14, she told him she was 16, that nothing happened until at the time that he would have believed she was 17. She didn't correct the record, if you believe that she did. He denied that she ever corrected the record, and there was nothing to substantiate that it had been corrected. You know, her cell phone was broken, the computer was gone, the diaries were missing. So this, you know, ultimate admission that suddenly she corrected the record and told him she was 16, not 18, there was no evidence other than Katie's testimony.
And the jury could choose to believe or disbelieve that.
That's true, but it still shows a pattern. I mean, she admitted that when he would have thought she was 17 was when the sexual acts occurred. She hadn't corrected the record with him until he thought she was turning 18. So in terms of Carrie, it still followed the pattern that he would meet them when they were younger, but that nothing would happen until they were actually older. That happened with Katie, and that's what he indicated he intended with Carrie. So the facts of the case, I mean, Judge Bucklow held that she didn't believe that anything was going to happen that night, and that she believed that there was a possibility that the jury could have found that. That, in fact, be it a way of grooming, but the government still would have to prove that he went there on November 11th with the intent to commit a sexual act that night. It couldn't be for an act in the future, because that may never have happened, so then you're convicting a person for something that hasn't even happened yet. I mean, the intent, it's basically in Hensley, I believe, that the court holds, attempt is a substantial step toward completion, and it's demonstrated by the dangerousness, and that a defendant has to do something that makes it reasonably clear that had he not been interrupted or made a mistake, he would have completed the crime. And I don't think the evidence in this case shows that Brian Berg intended to or would have completed the crime.
Don't you want to talk about the closing statement?
Well, the improper vouching fits in with the rest of the argument in terms of, without the statement, they had absolutely no evidence that any sexual act was going to occur. And in the improper vouching, he vouched for the state's attorney. Clearly, Brian Berg challenged the statement in saying that I was bantered. Now the state's attorney comes in, takes a written statement from him. She writes the statement out. He doesn't write the statement. Judge Bucklow did not correct correct it with an objection. She never said disregard the arguments of the prosecutor. She just said move on. It was not invited conduct. We never put into issue that the state's attorney, one, was a respected state's attorney, or two, would lose her job and her livelihood if this statement were not true. We were challenging the statement itself because without the statement, they couldn't prove that he had any intent on that evening. In addition, we had no opportunity to rebut it. We had no opportunity to rebut it because it was given in his rebuttal argument. Finally, it was not invited comment. Am I out of time?
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. Schroeder.
Thank you.
Mr. Block.
May it please the Court, I'm Stephen Block. I'm appearing on behalf of the United States.
Can we start with the second verse? If we believe Berg's version of the confession, then isn't the assistant state's attorney credibility at issue? If Berg's account is correct, then the state's attorney's statement omitted critical evidence in his favor. That is that he continued to deny over and over an intent to have sex with Carrie.
So, Your Honor, would you like me to address the prosecutor's statement first?
If you don't mind.
Not at all.
Thank you.
The government concedes that the prosecutor's statement during the rebuttal is error, but that error is harmless. And the trial court found that the error was harmless in denying the motion for a new trial. This court reviews that decision for an abuse of discretion, and there is no abuse of discretion in this case because the error was, in fact, harmless because the evidence that the defendant was guilty of attempting to entice Carrie to engage in sexual activity is overwhelming. The defendant first contacted Carrie on May 30th, 2007, and Carrie identified herself as a 16-year-old girl at that time. And over a period of months, the defendant contacted Carrie again and again and engaged in explicit and graphic sexual conversations, and each one of these was initiated by the defendant. He sent her a picture of his erect penis on two occasions, and the defendant repeatedly asked Carrie what she liked to do sexually and what sexual acts he would like to perform on her. And this went on for months and months, and Judge Tinder hit it on the head. The defendant is charged not just with attempting to entice Carrie on November 11, 2007, the day that he was arrested, but through the whole period of their interaction. The charge language goes from May of 07 through November of 07 when he was finally arrested. And the reason is because during these chats, throughout the 5 months, he asked Carrie to meet up on no less than 16 separate occasions. He made a plan to meet her, and then he did, in fact, go to meet her on November 11, 2007, which is when he was arrested. So in looking at the evidence and looking at the prosecutor's statement, though error, and the overall context of the evidence, the error was harmless. In addition, when the defendant was arrested and after being given Miranda warnings, he gave a full written and oral confession. And the defendant testified regarding...
Can we talk about that confession? Let me just say this. If Berg's account is true, and he denied and denied and denied any intent to have sexual activity with Carrie, let's say I'm on the jury, and I actually hear a tape recording or I read a transcript of that account, I'm going to feel very differently about his confession, coupled, of course, with the other weaknesses that I believe exist in the government's case, than I am if I simply read the assistant state's attorney's account that he stated he would have had oral sex with Carrie. So the account of the confession would matter significantly to the jury's assessment of the case. Well, I mean, wouldn't you agree with that?
Yes, Judge, I certainly agree that the confession and circumstances of it are important in this case. And the defendant took the stand and testified regarding the confession. And he admitted on cross that he did in fact tell the state's attorney all of the statements that are in the confession. He went through that at some length during his cross-examination. And the state's attorney, her testimony was, in some senses, consistent with his. What they really were doing was attacking the credibility of the detective, and there was no improper vouching of the detective. That really was the defense's theory in this case, was the detective had badgered the defendant into providing a confession, not the state's attorney.
Well, but if the assistant state's attorney, credibility wasn't an issue, why the vehement plea to the jury that she was credible? What's going on here?
Well, Judge, there was error, and the government does concede that it was error. In looking at that comment in light of the entire record, we, as I said, believe it's harmless error. But we do concede that it was a statement that should not have been made. Moving on to the sufficiency argument, and to be clear, Judge Chinder, as you said, it's not an element that the defendant had to be intending to engage in an act of sexual activity on that night. These cases often involve grooming and other things, and that is why the defendant engaged in chats with this girl, or we believe to be a girl, for months and months.
You did need to show that he intended to do it before she reached the age of 17, otherwise it doesn't violate Illinois law, right?
That's correct.
So what's your proof of that?
Well, first of all, it's actually the defendant's burden to show that he believed that she was over 17. That was in the jury instructions that we agreed to in this case. As stated earlier, there was no precise birth date given for the girl. And so if we presume that she was born in 1991, and her email address was carryforyou1991, and that she was 16 years old when she first had a communication with the defendant, which was in May, it would have been over a year from then. She would not necessarily have been 17 for at least a year or up to a year from that point. So that would have been sometime in 2008, not in November of 2007 when defendant met this girl. So it would have been some period of time in the future, as early as date she could have necessarily been 17. And it was the defense burden to show that. They didn't come forth any evidence that he knew her birth date or believed her birth date was any time imminent and that he was waiting. That simply was not testimony in the record. The only testimony in the record is that he believed her to be 16 years old and that every time the girl communicated with the defendant, that she, when her age was discussed, it was that she was 16. There was never talk of returning 17, him asking her when she'd be 17. There's absolutely no evidence in the record regarding that. So going back to the sufficiency of the evidence argument, the elements, again, are not that he had to show or we had to show that he was going to engage in sexual activity on that date. It's that the defendant used a facility of interstate commerce to knowingly attempt to persuade and induce and entice an individual under 18 to engage in sexual activity, and then he took a substantial step towards the completion of that activity. Those are the two elements that are at issue here, I should say. There's other elements. And the chat transcripts show the state of mind, the intent to persuade, induce, and entice. And the substantial step is certainly when the defendant gets up from his computer and gets in his car and drives to meet her. That is, as this court has held in Gladish and Hensley and other cases, that is a substantial step towards completion of the offense, and it was more than enough for the jury to convict the defendant. So we are asking that the court affirm the defendant's conviction and sentence, and if there are no other questions, I'll rest on the government's brief.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.